welcome to the Anarchist Book Club, Danny Evans and me, Jimmy Omen. In this episode, we're delighted to be joined by Dr. Alexandra Paulin Booth to discuss her book, Time and Radical Politics in France, which was published by Manchester University Press in 2023. Alex's work treats the conception of time as both a window and a key into the left and right in France during the turbulent period between the Dreyfus Affair and the First World War. We hope you enjoy the conversation as much as we did.
Well, hi, Alex. Welcome to the podcast. Thank you very much for joining us. Very excited to have this conversation about your book. So first off, if you could say what attracted you to this particular period and why you wanted to look at this period in France in particular.
Yeah, so the book's called Time and Radical Politics in France, from the Dreyfus Affair to the First World War. So that's between the kind of 1890s to obviously 1914. And basically it's about how ideas about time and how experiences of time have an impact on political programs and on the development of political movements. So there's a number of reasons that I chose this kind of particular period, and a lot of them kind of don't actually have to do with political movements to start with. That came a bit later. So there are a number of ways in which understandings of time were changing. So obviously the Industrial Revolution for decades had been creating among some people a sense of acceleration, and also the increasing use of railways for transportation and communication technologies had been creating this idea that time and space were kind of shrinking somewhat. Then towards the end of the 19th century, so that process has been kind of ongoing for decades by the time you get to my period. Then towards the end of the 19th century, you get these attempts to kind of manage and track and formalize time. So in 1884, you get this big decision about Greenwich in London being the kind of site of the meridian. And then on top of that, there's evolutionary theories, which make people realize that there are kind of human ancestors in the distant past, and there are going to be human descendants in the distant future. Discoveries in chemistry and geology are prompting these realizations about the Earth being extremely ancient and not just, you know, kind of the 4,000 years old that the Bible might suggest that it was. There's Einstein's theories of relativity, there's philosophy, most relevantly to the people that I study, by Henri Bergson, about the intuition of time and about kind of subjective experiences of time. There's also artistic movements, futurism from 1909. So this basically, all of these different changes create this sense of kind of very uneven acceleration and expansion of past and future horizons, and a kind of sense of flux and uncertainty about the nature of time itself. And I was really inspired in kind of reading about all these changes by a book by Stephen Kern called The Culture of Time and Space. So it's really about kind of technology and about culture. But I wanted to ask, when I started the project, about how questions about time were being probed in the political sphere. So the things that I outlined a moment ago perhaps had an influence, but were there also kind of questions about time being asked that kind of went beyond those changes? So most obviously to me, it seemed that this doctrine of progress, a kind of idea of like steady improvement into the future that had been quite dominant for a lot of the 19th century, was really kind of breaking apart. And I developed a kind of particular interest in these radical thinkers of left and right, because they seem to engage with questions of time particularly intensively. They really desired abrupt change. They wanted to kind of ask about the ontological status of the past, what the threshold was between present and future. So not just what the future would look like in terms of its content, but what kind of time frame could it be ushered in? Was this about big revolution or kind of gradual transition? And what I found really were kind of three layers to the argument as I develop it in the book. So the first is that people often use the language of time to express their political missions. That seems kind of relatively obvious, I think. Then the kind of next deeper layer is that time was actually a part of the kind of architecture of political thought, like it structured how people thought about their political programs. And then there's the idea that time was sort of contested terrain. So it could cause disputes, or it could kind of occasion consensus, sometimes in quite unlikely ways. And then finally, I write about how notions of time influence other prominent issues. So nationhood, social change, revolution, all these ideas were kind of filtered through notions of time. The thing about France particularly, the thinkers that I'm studying all had kind of particular responses to the French Revolution of 1789. So they might have seen it as a kind of great, brilliant rupture that thrust society into the future, or as this kind of terrible rift that had torn France away from its prestigious past. But that, whichever kind of reaction thinkers had, it prompted a lot of thought about the nature of past and future. And that kind of really interested me in this particular French context. But I also wanted to mention that I don't think that these ideas or these experiences are kind of completely unique to France. Like, they're important and they have a kind of particular dimension in France because of this heritage and because of other things that we'll go on to discuss. There's also lots and lots of periods and places where something really interesting could be revealed by applying this kind of lens of temporality. So, like, just looking at my bookshelf now, there's a book by Roman Krakowski about time in communist Czechoslovakia called Reinventing the World. So, yeah, this idea of a kind of total reinvention of time and space under communism. Then there's also a brilliant book by Matthew Champion about the 15th century Low Countries and about religious notions of time and music. So I think the kind of particular, like, lens that I've applied, that particular methodology, is actually really kind of broadly applicable. And, like, maybe the kind of meanings are specific to the thinkers I study, but the importance isn't necessarily unique. And I think in general, in periods of upheaval or periods of change, perceived crisis, ideas about time often come to the fore as people try to kind of use them to understand their experience of change, shall we say.
Just on that last point, I think that that's really key, because what I think, you know, your book is, I think you say this, and certainly something you take from the introduction, is that point that what you're seeking to do, you know, as well as talking about this specific moment, is make a methodological contribution, you know, with these different layers of understanding time and how that could, like, rings true in many other areas. And I think that really does come out right the way through. Time is something that's always kind of interested me, but I never spent lots of my academic career, like, looking at it, but always, you know, moments when you realize, kind of like you say, that, oh, like, the subjects I'm looking at are talking about time, or they're talking about this in ways that time has, like, framed and structured, and having that laid out methodologically in your book, but then also applied into this fascinating context, I think works really well.
If we move on to some of the specific figures and groups that you examine, you know, you start with the aftermath of the Dreyfus Affair in France, and I thought this would be a good thing to talk about, because I always find it striking just how important the Dreyfus Affair was, rather like the younger generations that get bemoaned by the radicals after the affair has kind of ended. I find it hard to feel its significance, despite how clearly this was felt by those involved in the campaigns. I mean, it reaches out, you know, it's present there in the anarchist press in Spain at the time. I'm sure it has an international audience, you know, in many countries. But what you do really is really stress its significance in France. So can you give our listeners a sense of the weight of the Dreyfus Affair and how it impacted on conceptions of time to the radicals of the Third Republic?
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of extraordinary the weight that the Dreyfus Affair brought to bear on politics and on political movements. So for people who maybe aren't aware of it, the Dreyfus Affair was basically the case of a wrongly convicted Jewish army officer in the mid-1890s, Alfred Dreyfus. He was convicted of spying for the Germans. The case is, this sort of started happening around, like, right at the end of 1894, and he was convicted, sent to Devil's Island off the coast of French Guiana, and then he kind of languished there for a couple of years. And the case was quite slow to come to public attention. It wasn't really until the kind of towards the end of 1897 that people started to take notice of it. But after that, it really, really spiraled in the press, and it really hugely, hugely dominates the press for the next few years. And there's relatively few other things that kind of compete for that space in the newspapers. It really is so dominant. It turned into a kind of a nation cut in two, is how one historian puts it. So it's almost as if there's kind of two Frances vying for the nation's soul. This is how it was described at the time, and how it's kind of still described today. So there were people who were campaigning really vociferously for Dreyfus's retrial and for his conviction to be overturned. And they're people who believed that this was really about the kind of values of the Republic and the heritage of the French Revolution being at stake. So this is about justice and about kind of defending even the like Republican form of government. Then on the other side, there were people who insisted on Dreyfus's guilt, and they wanted to uphold the kind of integrity, so-called integrity of the army. And there was a bit of a sense among them that even if this one person had wrongly been convicted, then really there were kind of bigger issues at stake, which were about protecting the army and protecting France. So it really kind of highlighted the need for change, either to push for kind of justice and social improvement, defend Republican values, or to protect specific versions of the heritage of the nation. And the Dreyfus affair has kind of come to be known in historiography as this moment when the kind of politically engaged intellectual is born. And there were huge amounts of activism during the Dreyfus affair. So the characters that I study were really intensively engaged in this. And I think it's really important to stress that this wasn't kind of exclusively a process of looking at it and saying, okay, you know, I think on the balance of probabilities that Dreyfus is innocent or Dreyfus is guilty. This was really a process of kind of very intense and slightly unpredictable emotional mobilization. Friends disagreed, friendships were lost, new friendships were created. It really had a lot of emotional power. And that's something that really like struck me when I started reading the literature about it, is that people really wrote quite openly about their emotional experiences of being activists during the Dreyfus affair. But onto that kind of personal emotional plane was kind of superimposed this idea of the nation. It was the nation that was at stake. And that also obviously had a great kind of emotional weight, but it was also described in the sense of a kind of epic time frame. So this is a kind of battle for the entire history of the nation, but also a battle for the kind of distant future. And as the affair developed, I noticed in the sources that I read that there was a kind of widening gulf between what might loosely be called the left and what might loosely be called the right. And that widening gulf was often described in terms of time. So people on the left were likely to talk about how the affair had kind of stripped back this veneer of progress. We'd returned to the atavism of the Middle Ages, blind hatred, anti-Semitism. All of these things are described in terms of a kind of a past that was thought to be buried and was then kind of suddenly and unwelcomely resurrected. And then on the other side, it's often described as a process of a kind of unwelcome transformation, which needed to be guarded against. And conservation was the watchword. And the affair came to be kind of quite openly described as a battle between past and future. So you get these temporal categories that were kind of evoked as like an emotive shorthand. And obviously, like I mentioned just a minute ago, the heritage of the French Revolution played quite a large role in this. And I think at first when I saw that was happening in the sources, it seemed to me that this was just about a kind of, this is a dispute over the past, this is a dispute over history. But as I kind of read more deeply into it, I noticed that the protection of the French Revolution was actually about the kind of protection of a future orientation of a revolutionary tradition. So it's not just about a kind of particular version of the past, about, you know, what happened in history. It's about like how we go forward into the future as a nation. Just to kind of wrap up the story of the Dreyfus affair. So Dreyfus was brought back to France in 1899 for a retrial. He was convicted again, in fact, and then he was kind of hastily pardoned after these sort of backroom political deals. And then only in 1906 would he be fully exonerated. For many activists coming from a kind of broadly left-wing perspective, there was this sudden moment of like, right, we have to change things. And how do we do that? And one of the kind of quite concrete ways that people decided to do that was mounting this education initiative, kind of popular education initiative called the Université Populaire. And that was kind of founded quite explicitly with the idea of pushing back this kind of ugly, prejudiced past that had reared its head during the Dreyfus affair. And what it looked like in practice is a kind of series of small education institutions that had evening lectures, so like crucially after work lectures, on a really wide range of topics. History, sanitation, literature, the dangers of alcoholism, a kind of a wide range of things. And initially, among the activists who kind of mounted the initiative, there was this kind of real burst of hope and hope for change and everything. And that really kind of quite quickly dissipated just within a couple of years. And there's lots of reasons that the Université Populaire failed. I think there just like wasn't a lot of uptake and a lot of appetite for people who've worked really long hours to go to lectures in the evening at a kind of really basic level. Yeah, so it was kind of a difficult initiative to mount, but in some of the kind of dissections of what went wrong, there was this sense that they were kind of creating, there was this very small window of opportunity in which things needed to change very quickly. But really the aim of the change was really, really long term. So it was this kind of across like generations, this thing would come to fruition. And the change that they were aiming at just kind of couldn't quite have enough meaning in people's lives, in the kind of lifetime of one individual. That kind of really struck me as like an interesting and kind of slightly abstract analysis for why this movement had failed. But they're kind of quite explicit about it. And then you also got a kind of broader dissolution of the Dreyfus Front, and lots of people felt kind of quite disillusioned with the activism. Like way beyond the Université Populaire, there was a big sense of disillusionment, and there was also a sense of being kind of cut off from younger generations. That the affair had kind of created this very intense activist generation of 1890 that then found it very difficult to kind of communicate its experiences to younger generations who couldn't quite understand the weight of the affair. And all of these things, like particularly this sense of disillusion, was spoken about in terms of time. It's definitely something that could be applied to an earlier era, most notably with the commune. So this kind of like sudden changing society, which then quite quickly failed to leave a sense of disillusionment, but it's also applicable to much later periods. 1968, I think you could do a kind of study of like a temporally based disillusion. And then there's also, I think I quote this in the conclusion of the book, the writing by Hannah Arendt about the resistance and about revolutions. And she's quoting this résistant called René Char, who was a poet and a member of the French resistance during the Second World War. And basically she's kind of using Char's poetry to say that revolutions often kind of present this treasure and then it's like sudden removal or even its conscious rejection. And that leaves this sense of being kind of adrift in time. Yeah, and I think that's also quite interesting. Like, I think this is really applicable across many different periods. And that's just kind of examples, like largely from France. But you could obviously go way beyond.
Yes, I feel like it really speaks to my own life. I remember feeling that was very moving. I mean, I don't know if it's an apocryphal quote of Lenin's, because I don't know what text it comes from. And, you know, sometimes you see these like famous quotes knocked about. But I assume he said it, which is that one about how there are decades in which nothing happens and weeks in which decades happen.
Yeah, I've read that. I don't know what it's from or whether it's genuine. But yeah, that really speaks, I think, to a lot of, or would certainly have spoken to a lot of the characters of my study and how they were experiencing time.
Reverse though, isn't it? It's like, I think the famous story with Lenin is that just before he hears about the February Revolution in 1917, he's like giving a lecture where he says, you know, obviously none of this socialism stuff's going to happen in my lifetime, but maybe you in your lifetime it will, you know, and then suddenly things like speed up. So presumably that quote is intended to like be hopeful, you know. It's whereas the Arendt one like reverses it. So what do we do with the empty time afterwards? You know, it's like that question, what side of time are you on?
Yeah, I mean, I think it does also speak to this kind of broader issue that you've both alluded to in terms of modernity and kind of historiographies. It's tempting to think about modernity as being defined like purely and exclusively in terms of this sort of all-consuming acceleration, but that's something that I think a lot of the literature is good at kind of pushing against. So even kind of older theorists of modernity, so notably this kind of very famous conceptual historian, Reinhard Koselleck, who I use a lot in my work, he noted that acceleration kind of created these slightly weird pockets of deceleration. And I also kind of drew on two German sociologists called Hartmut Rosa and William Scheuermann, who write about how in the kind of contemporary context, acceleration might kind of seem to define a lot of social life, but you need to be really aware of where that acceleration isn't happening. So people who are retired, for example, people who are on long-term sick leave, that like they might actually experience their lives completely in terms of deceleration, which is contrasted with this kind of sense of social acceleration happening kind of outside of them. And I thought that kind of inspired me to be a bit skeptical about a kind of monolithic model of modernity.
This question of modernity and there being these kind of multiple modernities, and I guess in relation to your work, multiple time frames and experiences of the speed of time and how that plays out into different politics. And that's where I think having this kind of dual focus in your book on the right and the left really shows that. So, if we've looked from the kind of the left side post-Dreyfus as well, I found the following chapters on the right as well really quite affecting when you talk about this despair felt by the right, the despair of the present, and how it felt totally stuck in this moment in the early 20th century. Traumatized, some of the language you use, by defeat and national humiliation following the Franco-Prussian War. And then you get this the kind of newer grouping. Is my French going to be tested? Is it Action Française? Wow, I'm nailing it this evening. Yeah, so their efforts to kind of reconcile this, to kind of come to terms with this moment, you put it in terms of reconciling a deep past and a distant future as a way of getting over this despair of the present. And it did, as someone that's taught on fascism and its origins and in Europe, it did ring a few bells. It's obviously not identical to kind of 1930s fascism in time, but and I know that AF had this role in seen as one of the early sort of proto-fascist movements by some. And I just wondered if that idea, there's an idea that, that runs through fascist ideology about palingenesis, about this kind of idea of resurrecting a long lost and defeated past. And if time isn't something I've found used very often in those kind of origins of fascism discussions about its ideology. And I wondered if you felt that was one way of knitting that into that particular strand of modernity.
Yeah, absolutely. So the palingenesis thing is the Roger Griffin thing, right? He's kind of saying that this idea of national rebirth is one of the kind of essential elements that you need in order to have fascism. And without the idea of national rebirth, it's kind of not necessarily fascism, along with populism. And I mean, I guess nationalism to memory, it's been a while since I read the book, but I think there's definitely some of that in the right-wing movements I study. They have this kind of this restless quest to identify what's eternal about France. So is France embodied by mothers? Could it be embodied by a resurrection of the monarchy? And that's something that in the literature is kind of explicitly linked with time. It's kind of buying, the monarchy buys France time to heal. But I'm also kind of quite cautious about the comparison with fascism, because I mean, you have this kind of quite prominent strand in the historiography, which led by Ziv Sternhell, which suggests that fascism was basically effectively kind of fully formed in France between the kind of 1880s and the beginning of the First World War. And that's something that I don't particularly agree with, and that has been quite heavily criticized, because it kind of negates the impact of the First World War in the formation of fascism. It also kind of negates all these aspects about implementing the fascistic ideas that you might find pre-war, negates the importance of kind of how movements are formed, how mass political movements are formed. Nonetheless, in terms of the ideas, yeah, there are definitely real important, not just comparisons, but you've used the word proto-fascist, and I think there's some truth in that kind of proto-fascist elements, particularly when it comes to kind of identifying and protecting this kind of racialized, essentialized vision of the French nation. But then it also, in the movements that I study here, so I look at three kind of different right-wing groups. They're really diverse in terms of what they actually think this national rebirth could or should be. So increasingly in Action Française, they're quite monarchist. So this obviously kind of doesn't really fit with the fascist comparison that well. But yeah, I do think there's something in it. Yeah, and I was really struck when I was reading the sources from the nationalist movements that I study that, you know, I think a lot of right-wing literature, a lot of kind of older conservative right-wing literature is about, you know, the present is bad and, you know, perhaps we need to go back to the past or perhaps we need to find some kind of inspiration for the past. And that I was kind of expecting to find, but what really struck me was the extent to which, at least in the sort of early part of the period that I study, there's a lot of condemnation of the very concept of the present. Like, it's not just that the present has things in it that we don't like. It's the idea that the present is this sort of empty category, basically. So you get people like a kind of not especially famous monarchist called Léon de Montesquieu, who wrote about how the universal rights developed during the French Revolution were terrible because they basically only focused on individual rights, and an individual is only in the present. And actually what we need is a kind of concept of rights that goes across generations. And he developed this kind of quite elaborate extended metaphor about how he could walk through a forest and the trees that were sheltering him from the intemperate weather had only been planted by his kind of great-grandfathers, and he might plant trees that would only in turn shelter his great-grandchildren. And we needed a kind of concept that went way beyond this this idea of the present. So the present is kind of associated with individualism, and it's not just about like we need to get through these things that we don't like. It's about saying actually we need to sort of transcend this in order to unite the past and the future, which I found really striking and I kind of wasn't really expecting to find. I mean, I was expecting to find much more stuff about how we should just like return to the past and the past was great, and that wasn't really that kind of defied my expectations in a way that I found quite exciting. And when they do talk about returning to the past, it's quite a sort of like anxious theorizing. So the beginning of the Action Française journal is all about what the past is. Could you return to it? No, the past is a kind of springboard, but we need to develop a future. It's not really possible to resurrect the past. And that I think is a bit of a testament to how important ideas about time were. Like, there are these really concerted efforts to ask about what temporal categories actually are and like what can we do with them.
Thinking about time in this way just made me think that I think I'm used to thinking about the right in general as holding more cards than the left, in the sense that, you know, their activity and ideas are reflective of dominant ideologies, and, you know, and they're intended to like to maintain existing power relations. So obviously that has a, you know, they have a great advantage in that sense. But I was thinking like this way of thinking about time and this widespread understanding of time could be potentially quite paralyzing for political action. So by contrast to the left, which has an idea that, you know, the present state of things can be redeemed by the future, right? That we can be, that our lives can have meaning through a political action that brings about the end of the present state of things and the beginning of real human history, right? And the understandings of some people. Whereas for the right, it's like, you know, this is the present is a moment in an unfolding catastrophe in which the past is lost. And the future is the end of everything that has given them meaning, right? Their existing power relations, civilization, empire, whatever it might be. So why is it that, or how is it that the right managed to act politically effectively, given that, you know, you would think that that understanding of time would be paralyzed?
Yeah, you're absolutely so right. And I think just to say on your first point, I think it's really interesting the kind of conceptualization of the right holding more cards, because I think the kind of very like fringe radical right wing thinkers that I study wouldn't think of themselves in that way at all. Like, they really saw themselves as kind of, a lot of them as kind of, I guess, sort of victims.
Don't you think that's like really common to like the right, like across a time and space as well? Like, I mean, the right is constantly presenting itself as on the defensive. Today it's extremely common, you know, that's how the right present themselves all the time. But I think, like, you know, to critical observers, that it's not like credible.
Yeah, and I'm just now thinking actually that, like, I'm not sure how credible it was in this time either, because a lot of the kind of leading thinkers that I study were actually like quite kind of integrated into like parliamentary politics and the kind of institutions of the Third Republic. So like maybe that's, yeah, I think actually it might, although the like rhetoric, obviously they need to kind of make it cut against that sense that they're dominant. I'm not sure that really holds up. Yeah, and I think that's a really, really insightful point. I mean, I think what's definitely true though is this sense that, so a lot of the three right-wing groups that I study, and particularly the Ligue des Patriotes, which is a kind of like militaristic organization, which was largely founded on the basis of needing to take back the lost provinces of Alsace-Lorraine from Germany, which had obviously been captured in the Franco-Prussian War. Captured and annexed in the Franco-Prussian War in 1871. That group is really kind of responding constantly to this sense that France has been dismembered, it's been ripped apart, and they get kind of, and I use sort of trauma theory to try and illustrate this, they actually kind of get stuck in this space where they're constantly sort of repeating or going back to the traumatic incident in the past, and as such they kind of become a bit unable to like move forwards. That does kind of create a sense of paralysis until there's a kind of younger generation of activists who are mainly associated with Action Française rather than the Ligue des Patriotes, but they a lot of them are kind of younger students and they're part of a sort of militant group known as the Camino du Roi, and they really kind of change the way that the right do things in France, the far right at least. And they manage to kind of imbue this sense of disgust with the present, with a kind of need to change things by action, through action, rather than kind of simply repeat the traumas of the past. And then it's at that moment that you get kind of more, to put it really bluntly, less writing and more action. And the sort of anxious theorizing of the Action Française journal turns into this kind of daily newspaper, which has all these kind of bursting, hurried condemnations. You know, they're constantly kind of condemning school teachers for teaching the wrong things. Nominations to the Académie Française have always got some kind of problem with them. Yeah, and I think that's the moment when you get this kind of sense of maybe being able to transcend the present. But also, I mean, I think a minute ago you used the phrase like effective political action. I think it's kind of worth mentioning that none of the groups I study here really have very effective political action. And I think actually it's in their failures that they kind of become more interesting, because they're all kind of quite impotent fringe groups who are kind of constantly disappointed. And, you know, they wish they had more militants, and they kind of talk a lot about toppling the Third Republic, but it's never really that strong of a possibility for any of the groups that I study on left or right. But I think their kind of reflections on these failures are also just quite interesting.
Is it not the case then that these like fringe groups, I mean, I don't want to make like too easy a parallel with like, say, the UK, but like there's quite a few like right-wing fringe groups, whether street-based or parliamentary, of the past 10 to 20 years or so, which have been on their own terms failed projects, but which have left an extremely strong sort of social residue that has helped shape the parameters of national discourse and imagination in pretty dispiriting ways. That's not something that you could say it was the case with France in the years leading up to the First World War, and was obviously like a nationalist mobilization in 1914.
I don't think the parallel is like completely misplaced. And we also had the kind of example a minute ago of fascism, and fascism partly taking from these ideas that have been developed during this period. Obviously in 1914 you get the Union Sacrée and the kind of uniting of right and left to defend the nation, you know, rather than a kind of socialist workers' revolution, which I think was the hope of many on the left in Europe at the time, and it just kind of doesn't happen at all. It's actually this real kind of siding with the nation and the right to quite a large degree. Yeah,
I suppose, I mean, there's possibly a parallel universe where socialist revolution did save us from the 20th century, and that leads us into the field of speculative literature, which you also write very effectively about in your book. And the early 20th century is like golden period of like the first, I think it's like the first science fiction in like different languages. You point to like an overlap through this like futuristic literature or fictional literature between like right and left anxieties in this time. You write about Maurice Spronck and Daniel Alloway.
Perfect.
Thank you very much. The latter being the Dreyfus side, who would later become a right winger. But these anxieties about the future, which perhaps particularly revolved around like questions of automation replacing work, and means by which like those divisions that the Dreyfus affair had appeared to bring about in French society that you talked about before, started to become more blurred.
I think that's definitely true to an extent, but there's also quite kind of stark differences around how automation is discussed in the kind of speculative fiction that I write about. So it's obviously emerging from this kind of much broader desire to write kind of futurist fiction, H.G. Wells probably being the most obvious example, but there are numerous others. And I've taken four examples of the genre. Two of them are kind of quite squarely from a left-wing perspective. One is Elegie, who occupies this kind of intermediate space. And then one is Schponk, who is kind of much more obviously right-wing. And they all are concerned, or they all are interested in automation and mechanization replacing work. And in the two left-wing examples, this is really a kind of glorious possibility. So you might not have to work at all because there are machines that can do your work, or you're just going to work a few hours a day. So in one of the books, I think it's the one by Eugène Fournier, he writes about how you could do a few hours of work maybe in the morning, and then in the afternoon you kind of do like political debate. It sort of evokes this famous Marx quotation about like fishing and philosophizing. And then in the more kind of right-leaning works, it's this sort of terrifying, hellish scenario where actually if you don't have work to structure your day and to structure your life, you're just going to kind of completely go off the rails. And they really have this like quite kind of dramatic vision of how bad things are when people don't work enough hours. So Schponk writes that, like, you know, first people worked for 8 hours a day, then six, then two, and then basically kind of society fell apart. Women stopped having children. Olivier is much more kind of in depth, and he writes a lot about how people kind of succumbed to alcoholism, drug addiction, when they didn't need to work. And in his kind of futurist story, there's this like synthetic foodstuff that people eat and that is like very, very easily and cheaply produced. So no one really has to make any effort for anything, which to some people might sound great, but to Olivier, it's like the sort of source of social ill. So I thought that was kind of interesting as a way of seeing that like work needs to kind of structure your time, even on a day-to-day basis. It has this sort of disciplining quality, whereas in the kind of two more left-wing books, it has this kind of like liberating quality where, you know, time is your own, you're the kind of master of your time, and that's a kind of powerful thing rather than a threatening, menacing thing.
I can think of like other like sort of left-wing examples that take a more dim view of the possibilities of automation, or at least like that hold to like an understanding of work as being like a good in itself, or like non-alienated work being a good in itself or redemptive and things. News from Nowhere is of that.
Yeah, definitely. And a couple of the examples, I think Anatole France actually writes about news from Nowhere as one of his kind of inspirations. I think it's probably important to mention that it's not just like having the kind of the complete like freedom of time. It's the way that you can use your time to choose to do things that are fulfilling to you. So that might be some kind of more artisanal work, it might be philosophy, it might be statistics, but you get to choose that kind of non-alienated form of work. But I guess, yeah, in that sense, it's these examples I think are relatively similar to what you're describing, that they do believe in the sort of healthy value of work.
Since we've started talking about the left a bit, perhaps we could like get onto like conceptions of proletarian time and how that counterposed itself to dominant understandings of time in this period. So there's a famous bit in Walter Benjamin's thesis on the concept of history where he talks about workers in Paris shooting the clocks during the 1830 uprising. And then there's a very famous essay by E.P. Thompson on time and discipline, in which capitalist time is presented as an imposition on the emerging like working class. So how did the socialists and syndicalists conceptualize proletarian time? You know, particularly once like this capitalist time has effectively won out, you know, that both Thompson and Benjamin are referring to a period in which industrial time could still be resisted by people who had a different how a different conception of how time would work, you know, that was subsisted after the moving from a country to the city, for example, or something. But so once you have like a kind of fully fledged industrial capitalist society, how were the left able to conceptualize time in a way that still remained like a challenge to dominant understanding?
Yeah, it's a great question. I mean, it's complicated because in the, I say the final chapter of the book is about the syndicalist movement. And syndicalists were very concerned with kind of looking at working class life and really understanding it. They wanted to kind of avoid this sense of theorizing from above. They wanted to kind of base everything in practice. And one of the things they noted was that proletarian time was kind of shaped really forcefully by capitalist time in the day-to-day. So they talk about it basically in terms of like an imposition, in terms of acceleration, in terms of kind of rapid change, almost a sort of unmanageable pace of change creeping in. And I think it's notable that one of the kind of biggest concrete demands of the workers' movement in the late 19th, early 20th century in France was the 8-hour working day. But that even that kind of wasn't simple, because you had people saying, well, actually people don't have like a full rest day normally in their week. So like, is it worth kind of protesting for an 8-hour day, or should we actually be protesting first for a weekend and then we do a kind of 8-hour day? So there was lots of discussions about how this kind of time could be managed in the day to day. And it is basically discussed as the sense in which capitalist time had kind of entirely created proletarian time, if that makes sense. Like there's not so much of a distinction between capitalist time and a proletarian time. But then there's another layer to it, which is this kind of this faith in the proletariat's future victory. So there was one Italian syndicalist writing in a French journal at the time saying that the proletariat have kind of indefinite time. And actually, you know, we intellectuals need to be aware of that. Like our time is not the kind of useful one. We need to tap into this indefinite time. And obviously there's a sense in which this is picking up on Marx and the proletariat as the kind of culmination of history. And the characters of this study use Marx in quite kind of funny ways. There's not really like a stable Marxism. It's kind of debated, critiqued, discussed, but the kind of proletariat as the culmination of history is one thing that they kind of agree on and they write about a lot. And they also write about the sense in which capitalism is almost this machine kind of spinning out of control. So it's sort of always teetering on the edge of collapse. And what they wanted to do is say, okay, we're going to build this kind of embryonic future social organism within the kind of teetering, madly spinning capitalist order. And we can kind of incubate that, and that is then going to be our future society. And so I think that's how they kind of get around this block of like, proletarian time is created by capitalist time, but capitalist time also needs to be resisted, and not just in the day-to-day with the 8-hour demand, but also in the sense of like thinking about the philosophy of history and how the future is gonna develop as a way of kind of building this kind of more authentic proletarian embryonic future society. There's lots of discussions about initiatives to kind of give the proletariat their history. So there's one famous syndicalist, Fernand Pelloutier, who has this project to put kind of historical exhibitions in labour exchanges. And this is something that he says is kind of really important for the proletariat to have their future. They need their past. And that kind of also plays in here. And then you also kind of have the general strike, which emerges in the syndicalist movement as the kind of preeminent way of creating a revolution. And this also allows some of the thinkers and activists that I write about to kind of think their way out of this problem of, well, we're not entirely satisfied with reformism because it's just sort of treading water in the present. And we also acknowledge that the great age of revolutions is probably over. Like we're probably not going to get a kind of sudden conflagration that transforms everything overnight. And actually building towards a general strike through a series of kind of smaller piecemeal strikes kind of seems to like unite these two time frames. In practice, that didn't really work because the revolutionaries and the reformists were always at loggerheads within the syndicalist movement. But this at least is the theory for a period of time.
You can definitely see from within that time period how that would make kind of logical sense. But definitely the question of urgency is lessened, isn't it, when you have like a sense that time is on our side anyway. you know, because we will be the inheritors of capitalism's collapse sooner or later. I was wondering whether, you know, if there's any kind of disruption of that way of thinking in this period, because, like, if you think about how, like, say, the Marxist movement in Russia conceptualized revolution as being, like, as helping, you know, the revolution that they imagined in the early 20th century was, like, a revolution more or less analogous to the French Revolution of 1789. You know, that they thought they hadn't had that stage yet, and they required that in order to then move on with the socialist project. But that was always, like, you know, it was always going to be a contradictory and difficult thing to try and build a movement, a socialist movement, that would push for a capitalist revolution. You know, that would then, like, just because it would potentially benefit, like, future generations of people, but people obviously want to, like, improve their lives there and then. And then when you have, like, the Russian Revolution of 1905 seemingly indicating that people who hadn't had this, like, long period of apprenticeship in industrial organizing and things like that, nevertheless, like, embarking on this, like, massive empire shaking strike wave and period of, like, social revolt and rebellion, you know, did that, like, maybe jolt some of those more, you know, I don't want to say, like, complacent, because it sounds like I'm sort of judging the past from my vantage point, but, you know, that sort of more confident understanding of, like, the unfolding of time that existed in the French labor movement.
It's a really, really important point. I mean, two things in particular I want to pick up on. So first, this idea of, well, actually, kind of, we've got time on our side because eventually we will win. This is something that really comes under a lot of criticism from different quarters. So there's a lot of critiques of Marxism based on this idea, saying, okay, well, you know, actually, we're not on a kind of conveyor belt towards a future revolution. But then I think for basically all of the thinkers that I study, they always get stuck between saying, well, definitely the left will win out, and that means we don't need to do anything. You know, they're kind of, this is a really uncomfortable and sort of thorny series of issues that's kind of never really resolved, I think, to any great degree. And that's also when you get things like the philosophy of history recreated as evolutionary theory. So scientific discourse and evolutionary theories become this way of understanding the future in a way that's comfortable for many sections of the left. So it's a way of saying, actually, like, we are going to win, but this isn't because we're complacent and we have blind faith in Marxism. It's because evolutionary theory says that we're going to win. And that kind of allows some people, at least for a time, a way of kind of balancing this question of we have agency and the future is ours. But they're definitely not issues that ever kind of get settled. And you're quite right to bring in the Russian Revolution of 1905, because that unsettles these questions all over again. And it does so particularly from the perspective of French thinkers who are saying that this kind of great Russian revolt is almost a kind of revolt out of time. Like, it's happening out of order, because France is in the revolutionary vanguard. And, like, France had its revolution in 1789. And, you know, that means that it's going to have to be the first to have a kind of great proletarian revolution, because it had its great kind of bourgeois capitalist revolution. It's really kind of interesting and funny to see the extent to which thinkers are kind of, particularly kind of revolutionary syndicalist thinkers, are so excited by the Russian Revolution of 1905, but also feel kind of put out by it. And they feel like it kind of leapfrogged them. They feel like it's, you know, it's their turn. And, you know, they haven't been able to kind of make this happen. And that's it's quite kind of fun to see how much that disrupts their vision of the unfolding of history, even as they're extremely kind of excited and encouraged and inspired by it.
Thanks for listening. The first ABC edition pamphlet, which is Danny's translation of Victor Garcia's José Genio Torrent, is now available to buy for cost price of £2 plus postage. And you can find some details on how to order that in the notes to the show. You can keep in touch with the podcast via abcwithdannyandjim@gmail.com and on Twitter @abcdannyandjim. Although we're not the most diligent of checking that feed anymore. You can subscribe to the podcast newsletter abcwithdannyandjim.substack.com. The podcast music his steering orchestra and Rafael de Nocio, Gente de Miña Terra. The podcast logo is an adapted version of the Left Book Club logo, and the image in this episode is the cover of an issue of La Voix des Peuples, hope I pronounced that right, in 1905, which is used on the front cover of Alex's book. Love and solidarity, until next time.
Senhor Presidente.